Okay, the meeting of the Environment Natural Resource Committee for January 23 will come to order. We have a quorum. And first thing on the agenda, members had a chance to look over and review the minutes. Anybody interested in moving the minutes?
Chair, so moved.
Representative Scalzi moves the minutes for January 18th, the Environment Natural Resource Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Well, today we are going to be hearing from both the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and also the Watershed Districts. The reason we're doing this today is we're going to be hearing the Legislative Auditor, their report on watersheds on Thursday. And I thought that it would be helpful to have some information today, a little background information on soil and water conservation districts and watershed districts and what they do, what their jurisdictions are. And so we're going to have first the soil and water conservation districts coming forward. And we're going to hear from a Ms. Leanne Buck from the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Also, Mr. Steve Sunderland, from the Chippewa County Soil and Water Conservation District, and Mr. Brian Watson from the Dakota County Soil and Water Conservation District. Before you begin, if you could just state your name and position for the tape, please, I'd appreciate that. So thank you and welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Leanne Buck. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation District. Steve Sunderland is Vice President of our association, as well as the Chippewa Soil and Water Conservation District Board Member, and Brian Watson with the Dakota Soil and Water Conservation District. Again, just to provide a quick overview, and then I'll defer to both of the local district representatives. The function of a Soil and Water Conservation District, and I'll be talking about the function of the district as well as the relationship that the districts have with other natural resource agencies. Soil and water conservation districts take available technical, financial, and educational resources and utilize those for the landowners so they can meet their conservation needs. We focus on voluntary conservation. We work with private landowners with, again, financial and technical assistance. Our history is kind of a long one. The legislation authorizing soil and water conservation districts came out of the Dust Bowl era in the 1930s. Each state was given from the federal government kind of a template of soil and water conservation district law. And from that law, there are now, each state has adopted that law and it's been modified over the years, and there are approximately 2,000 soil and water conservation districts across the United States. For Minnesota, again, we work with, today we work with urban and rural landowners alike, and we also work with several agencies, cities, and different municipalities for conservation practices. Again, we were authorized to implement conservation practices with the Minnesota State Statute 103C. It authorizes us to contract or enter into agreements with private landowners. It also allows us to enter into cooperative agreements with different agencies, including DNR, Bowser, other state and federal agencies. It allows us to do demonstration projects for different conservation practices. And again, it also allows us to work with provide equipment or machinery or different resources that a landowner might need to implement a conservation project. And another thing that the statute also authorizes districts to do is maintain different structures, like windbreaks, waterways that different landowners do erosion practices. And it also allows us to do a lot of comprehensive planning, which can be either with the local landowner doing the conservation plan on their property, or it can be entering into comprehensive plans at the county level, looking at their local water management plans that, again, that the state program that funnels to Bowser. Our structure, there are 91 soil and water districts. We're located in every county. We have county boundaries, and we also have, each district has 5 locally elected soil and water board members, which we call supervisors. So there are approximately 455 soil and water supervisors across the state, citizens that sit on these boards. The district staff also has technical staff that, again, provides the technical expertise needed to do design of different conservation practices, recommend planting, recommended different conservation practices. The focus for our work is on private land. 78% of the land in Minnesota is private land. So our niche, again, is working with private landowners to implement those conservation practices. And we also look at, basically the issue at hand is program delivery. The local district will look at what are the conservation needs in the county, what are the conservation needs for a landowner, and what type of practices should we do? Should it be a wetland restoration? Should it be buffers? Should it be some wildlife planting? What are those expertise that's needed to get those conservation? The districts are there to do that. And again, we're also looking at then how do we leverage federal, state, or local programs. When it comes to state programs, basically you authorize quite a bit of the programs that we work with. Our major agency that we work with for that is the Board of Water and Soil Resources. In a nutshell, they act as a funnel, and the funnel of those programs, again, includes the state cost share program, which is a program that provides maybe 50% or 75% of the cost to implement a conservation plan program, and the landowner pays the other half of that money. So again, there's state cost share, there's state feedlot cost share, there's the RIM reserve program, prep program. Those are all delivered through Bowser to the local district. Then we also have a federal partner. The federal partner is USDA, and the majority of the programs that we work with tend to be with the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Farm Service Agency. And so when we're working with the federals on those, the benefits that we have is most districts are co-located with those USDA offices. There also is an opportunity for districts and the federal government to share resources. It's sharing maps, it's sharing buildings, it's sharing internet. There's a lot of things that we do that benefits both the federal agency as well as the local district. And we also work quite a bit with the county government, county commissioners. And probably the major program for that is the local water planning that, again, U.S. legislatures appropriate to houses, and it's looking at each county having a plan to address their resource needs. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the other partners, which are DNR, PCA, Department of Ag. It just depends on what the needs are at the local level and what state agency has the program. Our funding for Stormwater District, an easy way of saying it is approximately a third. A little bit more comes from the county, approximately 39% of funding for districts comes to county, about 33% comes from the state, and the other 28% is made up through districts going after grants, charges for services. The other thing to keep in mind, we do not have tax levy authority. So again, the money comes from county, state, or local revenue that they derive themselves, local districts. So the accountability piece is, again, each stormwater district has 5 board members. So you have 5 locally elected citizens on those boards. We have annual reporting that we have to do through Bowser and their e-rate system. We have to look at audit requirements from the state. And there's also statute requirements with each of the programs. So there's quite a bit of accountability. Again, it's locally driven by the local board members. And at the end of the day, it's all about voluntary conservation. So we do work with landowners. So this time I'll turn it over to Brian, and he can finish up with the technical.
Thank you, Mr. Watson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Watson. I serve as the manager of the Dakota Soil and Water Conservation District. Now, I was going to give you a little perspective of technical assistance, the delivery of technical assistance at a Soil and Water Conservation District. Typically, technical reviews and assistance starts with a contact. Could be somebody who stops in the office, could be word of mouth, could be someone who gives us a call. And that initiates a preliminary review of an issue that they have, whether it's gully erosion, whether it's a wetland issue, whether it's an animal agricultural issue, could be a variety of different reasons or calling. Typically at the local level, we're close to the particular land in question. We can make a preliminary review either in the office or on site. And once we have an opportunity to meet and review the particular project site, we can act as a clearinghouse of information for that individual property owner. A variety of state laws, variety of local laws, variety of priority resources, both at the state and local level, gives us an opportunity to serve as an educational component on a one-to-one basis and speak with that landowner to look at the available options that are afforded to him. If it moves on from there and we have a project, we look at providing survey and design information. Now, there's different levels of complexity. with survey and design, but at a soil and water district staff level, there's technical approval authority, depending on the, again, the size of the project and the size of the watershed and what may be involved. And soil and water district staff provide that assistance to survey and design particular projects. We also might be involved with some rural interpretation at that point with that landowner. Then we move into project construction, and we have project construction oversight and also project compliance. So during the construction of a particular voluntary conservation activity, we would provide that technical assistance to that landowner to see that the project is put on the ground in compliance with the operation and maintenance plan that was provided. And lastly, we continue to provide oversight of the project as it's going through its stages of evolution. The project's in the ground. We need to see that the activity that was completed stays in compliance over a course of time. That varies from anywhere from 2, 3, 10 years of operation and maintenance plan compliance. So that's generally the assistance. There's a lot of different avenues that we communicate with landowners for projects, and there's a lot of different activities and best management practices that we provide to the landowners on a voluntary basis. I think at this point I'm going to turn over to Steve Sutherland, and he's going to provide a local board perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Sutherland, and I just wanted to give a short example of my first contact with the Soil and Water Conservation District. I'm a farmer, and many years ago I had a washout on a drainage ditch, and I wanted to get it fixed, and I didn't know where to go. I ended up in the Soil and Water Conservation Office, and their technicians were great. They knew what the problem was. They knew how to fix it. To my surprise, they had state cost share dollars to even help with it. They are my only source of state cost share dollars to do conservation out there. They did a great job. What was more impressive to me, I guess, is later I went to a board meeting, and there were five locally elected supervisors there that govern the SWCD. And what was surprising is that I knew them. They knew what my problem was, and one of them even knew where it was without even looking. That's what kind of, you know, how much better service can you get? They know the land, they know the people. And it's a great example of locally led grassroots private lands conservation, and it just, I can't express enough. I think it's a great delivery system. So thank you, Mr. Chair. If you have any questions for us.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Sunderland. And yes, Representative Cornish has a question.
For any of the three of you, let me give you a situation and then a personal problem. Down in Meyer in Faribault County in the Blue Earth River, we've got an American Legion that has a rifle range with some buildings on it. The Blue Earth River runs around it, and for the past couple of years, it's been undercutting where one of the rifle range buildings almost fallen in. Well, they don't have a dime. They're just struggling. And so they had a plan, but they didn't have any money to do it the right way. So they did it the wrong way, and they pushed concrete over the edge. Well, all hell broke loose, and the DNR came out and visited them. And now they're in the rock in a hard spot, and all they need is $2,000, but nobody wants to set a precedent. Earlier, a few years back, I had the same problem on the Watonwan River and on the Blue Earth River up near Mankato, where log jams get in, or it comes around a bluff, and this guy's house was actually falling in. Well, the feds, the only thing they would do to would be offer to give them about half the price for the house if he moved out. The county wouldn't get in. The DNR wouldn't do anything because nobody wants to set a precedent because it's happening all over the state, I suppose, and it'd be a huge amount of money. But if I was wondering if you folks could contact the Soil and Water District down there. I had contact with them and the county commissioner and the DNR. But it's been going on week after week after week, and there's not been any resolution at all. And I'm not, you know, putting the thumb on your or saying nobody's doing their job, but I just, for some reason, can't get an answer. And they had a contractor coming in now, and they're doing it the right way, but the contractor's doing it gratis because nobody's got the money to pay them. The Legion doesn't have a dime. So I wonder if there can be some a project money or something down there that might be available. And then somehow, if we can address this statewide, I don't know, but on our farm, we've got a log jam that's cutting into the riverbank, and the same story. We've contacted the hydrologist, and there's really no program for something that seems like of that magnitude. And if you had any ideas, I don't know. But.
Mr. Watson?
Chair, Representative, I guess I would just respond that there could be a lot of variety of issues associated with it, and but we can certainly contact the Faribault District and get the specifics on the project. Stream bank stabilization, sounds like concrete was used. The stream bank stabilization would be an eligible practice for the state cost share program. They have a tendency, depending on the size, and if you have a sizable river, to be fairly expensive projects to be done correctly. But there is that is a best management practice that's suitable to the state cost share program.
Thank you.
Ms. Buck. Representative, another follow-up. It sounds like a similar project, Lake of the Woods. I was on a tour with the Soil and Water District up in Lake of the Woods, and they had actually, it was a small resort that a landowner just purchased, and they had some flooding up there. And it was a multitude of projects, but they were able to get some special cost share dollars through Bowser, through the district. And so there may be some options again. So I will contact the Blue Earth Soil and Water Post.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Help me out once the project's been done. What is the obligation of a landowner to maintain that project? How long does that obligation last? And how do you track it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, typically it varies. The operation maintenance plan typically for a state cost share program is a 10-year lifespan. But it depends on the best management practice. The USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service and our federal partners have varying limits depending on the practice. As I mentioned, the state cost share program has a 10-year lifespan. And there's a variety of other programs that are incentive payments, such as Conservation Reserve Program or other filter, strip, or buffer programs that could go as long as perpetual. For instance, the land easements of the state. By longer-term type easements. So it really varies depending on the practice and depending on the local planning efforts.
Representative Wagenius.
Let me follow up. Are there some minimum standards for how long this project lasts and how it's maintained and then the tracking issue?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there is a minimum standards depending on it. I'll just use state cost as an example. It's 10 years. There's an operation maintenance plan that goes along with that that is provided to the landowner so they understand what the requirements and what the issues are with that practice. And then there is a tracking system that is used at a local level, which is referred to E-Link. That is administered by the Board of Water and Soil Resources, but entered the data is entered in at the local level.
Ms. Buck?
Just to follow up, too, it sounds like it were a rim easement. Once that's in a perpetual easement, then as the Soil and Water District, especially if you get into Minnesota River Valley where they have a number of easement programs, then it kind of, if they do have those requirements, the landowner knows that in the district then is obligated to do periodic spot checks. They don't get every single easement at 1 year, but they do periodic spot checks, which is a requirement for the district to follow up and go forward with that.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. A wholly different question. You keep referring to best management practices. How often do you update your practices to make sure they are indeed best management, because things that we thought were best management, maybe not anymore. And how do you then measure those to see if they are indeed a good management practice?
Mr. Chair, that's a continual effort, and it's been done through the engineering aspects with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Construction specifications change. Practices change. We're constantly looking at innovative and new ways to implement water quality projects, whether that's on rural lands or urban lands. They're continuing to look at construction specifications that meet the times.
Any further? Ms. Buck?
Representative Wiggins, part of it, some of the cost share practices that some water districts implement have been adopted by the Board of Water and Soil Resources have a set standard, and a considerable number of them are also adopted at the federal level, the Natural Resources Conservation Service. So they have a whole system within the federal government that looks at different scientific approaches to some of these best management practices. So we follow a field guide at the local level that's constantly being updated through the federal requirements that the districts have also looked at and adopted.
Representative Wiggins.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you feel that the federal government, I mean, generally when we speak of the federal government, we think of people slow and stuck in the mud. Do you think they are updating their practices rapidly enough?
Ms. Buck?
It's so general because you're talking everything from a marginal wetland restoration to a waterway to an engineering design. So I don't have an answer for you today because there's so many different variables with the different best management practices. Bowser staff of engineers that are constantly working with the USDA engineering services. Our organization periodically is requesting updates to the cost share practices and those kind of things. So it's trying to balance it. But I don't have a full, because it's such a broad spectrum, I guess I don't have an answer today for you. I can follow up with that.
Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to be hearing from the watershed districts, and see Mr. Ray Bone coming down for the Minnesota Association of Water Districts, and also Mr. Warren Sikora, who's the chair of the Wild Rice Watershed District, which is in my district. And Miss Barbara Hockey from the Rice Creek Watershed District, former member. So, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ray Bone, and I'm the administrator for the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, and to my left is Warren Sikora. Warren is the president of the Minnesota Association of Watershed District and also a manager and chair of the Wild Rice Watershed District in northwest Minnesota. And to my right is Barb Hockey, who's the vice president of MOD and also the member, manager of the Rice Creek Watershed District. And the only legislator I know that gave her a seat up so that she could return to be a watershed district man.
Much preferred it.
Don't blame you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I'd like to do is spend a little time, I'd like to kind of give an overview of watershed districts and then turn over to Mr. Sikora Warren and have him give kind of the greater Minnesota perspective on watershed districts and then ask Barbara Hockey to do the same thing, only as it relates to the metropolitan area. Because one thing about watershed districts, they are varied, they are different, they're all usually have been created for unique local opportunities, so they really are quite varied. So we're going to give you a kind of a broad overview today, and we are actually working on a publication with Bowser where we're asking all the watershed districts to give us some highlights, things they've been working on, and we hope to have that ready for you in the next week or two, and we'll share that with the committee, because I think that would really show you the breadth of things that we're working on across the state. Mark Twain once commented that whiskey was for drinking and water's for fighting over. And those of us in the watershed district world know how true those words are. Why are watershed districts established? Obviously, watershed districts are established because water knows no political boundaries. And clearly, if you're going to manage water properly, you've got to do it. You've got to manage all of it. You can't manage just part of it in an area and not the other part because there's a political boundary there that says this is where the authority ends or begins. So the idea of using watershed-based management is something that's really come into being in the last few years. Although it's interesting, in 1955, it was the federal government that saw watershed as an opportunity to really get a handle on watershed protection and restoration activities. So the Watershed District Authority was created by the legislature in 1955 in response to federal action. And what the watershed districts were a local entity, whereas they could respond, be responsive to the federal in terms of raising funds and regulation and acquiring land for those watershed-related activities that the feds at least an issue at that point, thought needed to take place. As a result of that act, watershed districts can be created anywhere in the state, and typically it comes from the local, by local petition, sometimes from the county commissioners, sometimes from local people, I think you need 50 people to sign a petition. We just started one a couple years ago down in Albert Lea because of the condition of the lake down there, and that was started by local petition of 50 citizens. And in addition to that, we're working on one right now, for example, in Mower County in Austin. And that one was started by the county commissioners because they felt there was really a need because of the flooding problems they're having down in Austin right now to get a handle on that. They had to go up to the entire watershed and deal with all the issues along the watershed to really deal with the flooding issues. The watershed approach really allows kind of the watersheds to tackle these tough, contentious issues. And, you know, we deal primarily more on a project basis, sometimes small projects, sometimes they're $50,000 or $100,000 projects, sometimes they're $8, $10 million projects, depending upon what the requirements are. We also, because we're organized on a watershed basis, can really deal with those upstream and downstream issues. You know, many people upstream, you know, don't realize what they're doing downstream, whether it's just the drainage, it's just, you know, coming into the river, flooding everybody downstream. Obviously, those are problems. Only to having a watershed structure can you really deal with those kinds of issues. In terms of our authorities, they're very, very broad, actually. We're a special purpose unit of government. We can adopt rules with the power of law. We can contract with units of government and private and public corporations. But what's interesting, I was reading this list over the other day, and the first thing it says in the statute, it says we can sue or be sued. So I thought that was kind of interesting for the statute. Hire staff and consultants, and I think one of the things that we're seeing, and one of the things I've seen with my 10 years at the watershed district, is that we're kind of being found out around the state, where we exist. People are finding out that if, you know, when it comes to water-related issues, they've been pounding our door and more and saying, will you help us or can you help us with this? And we're also seeing a number of watershed districts that have been created over the last few years. We can assess properties for benefits received and levy taxes to finance district administration. We can accept grants, both public and private, acquire property, acquire, construct, and operate drainage systems, dams, dikes, reservoirs, and water supply systems. And actually, a couple years ago, I think the legislature got special authority to actually have one of our watershed districts on a pilot project basis have the authority to work on a sewer system. And again, this is one of those issues that was off the lake. The township didn't want to deal with it. The cities didn't want to deal with it. So the watershed district was sitting there, and they approached the watershed district, would you do this? And we had to come in and tweak the law a little bit. Obviously, there's some concerns about the township, from the townships, how we were going to manage that. But in fact, the watershed district was really the only entity that was willing to take that on, and they have taken it on, and they've done a very good job. And I think it's like a three-tier lake now. They're handling the sewer system for that lake and building for it, and that's being taken care of. So those are just some of our very general duties. There have been 47 watershed districts created since 1955. We cover about 30% of the land mass of Minnesota. Basically operate off a small general fund tax that we levy, and that general fund is used basically primarily for administrative and then small projects. A lot of small projects are accomplished through that levy, and also education efforts and the other things that we do. The major first responsibility that any watershed district has is to prepare the watershed management plan. And the watershed management plan is critical to not only to give focus to the managers in terms of what are you going to be doing as a watershed district, but also allows that input from the cities, the townships, the counties, citizen groups, citizens, about what it is that you're going to try to accomplish over the next 5 years or so. I think that's normally the lifetime of a management plan typically tends to be 5 years. So what happens is that really forces the watershed district then to get out and to talk to stakeholders, communicate with them, and then come up with a plan. And once that plan basically is pretty much agreed to And I think it's pretty much a consensus agreement. I don't think it's the sort of thing where the board comes in and tries to shove things down people's throats, because they obviously got to work with all these people. All these people will, they'll have to work with and partner with in order for them to be successful. Once, you know, once that happens, then it's approved by the Board of Water and Solar Resources, and that's a process where there's some give and take. You know, sent into the board. The board looks at it, say, well, maybe you should do more in this area, do more here, think about this. And then when it's finalized, once it's finalized, that's your game plan. And then the manager or the chair of the watershed district, 8 months or a year down the road, can't wake up somewhere and say, well, I think we're going to do this project now. You know, if it's not in the plan, basically, you can't move forward with it. You can't spend money on it. So what you have to do is, if you decide that something comes up and you really want to do that as a board, then you have to go back and you have to go through that whole process. You know, notify the stakeholders, have the open meetings, let people know what you're planning on doing, what the cost is going to be, and then you have to gather all that input that then has to go back to Bowser, and Bowser has to sign off on it. And assuming it's not controversial, then that happens. I would say it happens on a regular basis, but it does happen. And then, of course, when you renew your plan and you do an updated plan every 5 years or so, then that gives you an opportunity to go back and look, where have I been, what have we done, and where do we need to be going? Because obviously, you know, times and circumstances change, and as you're making progress in different situations, you obviously need to move forward. The board, so really the management plan is a major item of accountability with watershed districts. You have to be accountable to that plan. The board of managers typically number 3 to 9 members, and I would say the typical number is 5. They're appointed by the county board, the county board of commissioners. They have to be members of the district. No county, state, or federal officials, elected officials, can be on the board. SWCD members, supervisors, can, however, be on the board. And we do have a number of SWCD supervisors that do serve on watershed district boards. In terms of other type of accountability, watershed district accountability, certainly the county commissioners. Many, I think by far the vast majority of watershed districts, while in the budget-making process, will appear, or the administrator will go before the county board and, you know, explain to them what their budget is for the next year, what they plan on doing, those sorts of things, and be available to answer questions. Now, does the county board have to approve our budget? No. No, you don't have to go for approval, but certainly you want the county on board, and you want them recognizing what you're doing is valuable and important, and hopefully they're in agreement with it, and clearly if they would have a problem, you'd have to sit down and chat with them and figure that out. But the Citizens Advisory Group, that's another very important group. This is every watershed district has to have a Citizens Advisory Group, and they're very, very intricately involved in all aspects of the watershed district, advising the managers in terms of what they should be doing, maybe providing actually some vision for the watershed district, depending upon the members. You know, everyone's different. Every advisory group plays a little different role. So I've seen some very, very active watershed district advisory committees with some very, very high-powered people on it. I think obviously watershed districts are accountable to the state laws, rules, regulations. Those are obviously things that probably don't need to be said. And also the constituents. I mean, we're all, you know, they're accountable to their constituents. They have their constituents. They get the phone calls. And I'll let them talk about that. But they certainly are accountable to the folks that they're representing. Watershed management in the Twin Cities is a little different. In that 1982, the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act was passed. And what that mandated is basically water management by watershed, by the 46 watersheds in the metropolitan area. So the 14 watershed districts that did exist at that point, actually there weren't quite 14, I think there were 9 or 10 at that point, they just were automatically made into what they call WMOs, water management organizations. So you can also, so what I'm saying is that you can be a WMO and you don't necessarily have to be a watershed district. But all watershed districts in the metro area are also WMOs. Now, I know that's probably perfectly clear, but it is a little confusing. It took me a while to figure out what that was all about. But basically, they grandfathered in the existing watershed districts as water management organizations. But really, in the metropolitan area, watershed districts operate under Chapter 103D and Chapter 103G, both of those chapters in their regulation work on Surface Water Act, under the Surface Water Act. With that, I guess what I'd like to do is turn it over to Warren and have Warren talk about what the watershed districts do in the real world out there. So, Warren?
Mr. Sikora, if you'd state your name for the tape, please.
My name is Warren Sikora. I'm chairman of the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts and chairman of the Wild Rice Watershed Districts in northwestern Minnesota. Good afternoon, Chairman Aiken, members of the Environmental Committee. Thank you for having us here today. Ray has kind of taken a lot of my thunder, so I guess I'm just going to pick up here and there on what I can. The law, like Ray said, that governs watersheds, for those of you that want to look at some research, is under 103E, 103B, 103D, and 103E. And 103E is the drainage law, which an awful lot of us watershed districts have to deal with, and that's with the conveyance of water to or from areas, wetland mitigation, all that type of thing. And the 103D, of course, is what gives watershed districts the charges or the purpose for of which they were established. Watersheds throughout the states do vary in size and location, but their goals and their objectives are pretty much the same, and they're made up of, like Ray said, 3 to 7 members appointed by the prospective counties, county commissioners. Now, this gives us the opportunity to work with land and water on a lot better playground, I guess you'd call it, according to some people, because it gives us the chance to work on a holistic approach to water. They're not constrained by political or county or regional boundaries. There are the members of these boards are friends and neighbors. They are also businessmen and women, farmers, lawyers, doctors, people from all walks of life. But they all have one thing in common, and that is to in some way improve the land and waters and in which we all try to enjoy. We all have either full-time or part-time administrators, full or part-time staff. It varies with the size of the districts. We also hire consultants to do our engineering and legal, accounting, and auditing. We meet once, twice a month, depending upon the activity of the district. Some districts meet 3-4 times a month. It just varies on what's going on. Now, each watershed district has a mission statement or guidelines that guides the district's outcomes as it manages one of Minnesota's most valuable and growing resources. Today, I was trying to figure out how to present, some of the highlights of different watershed districts, and I guess there was no simple way. With all the different things that watershed districts are doing throughout the state, it was a lot simpler probably to explain how a few watershed districts are doing things and how that fits into them 14 charges that watershed districts have. So I'm just going to give you a quick overview of a couple, 3 of the watershed districts in the area and in the outstate Minnesota and try to see how, if you like, say, if you go through the rules and the charges that are given to watersheds, see how they fit in. The Buffalo Red River Watershed District located in Barnesville covers about 1,379 square miles. Now, they were chosen 2 years ago by the Governor's Clean Water Initiative Cabinet for a pilot project in the Red River Basin called the Manson Slough Project. Now, this is a 1,320-acre wetland restoration. So this is just one of the aspects that they handled. It is also a water-level control structure to manage wetlands, and it also has upland treatments to control erosion and improve the water quality in that small watershed within their larger watershed. They've also completed the Deerhorn Creek levee project, which reduces flood damages by creating storage between an existing small river or ditch channel and by creating levees and impounding the water between this and restoring the restoration of the levee or of the river itself in between that levee. Bustle Red Watershed District has been named a Watershed District of the Year by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources in 1997 and 2005. So they work very strongly with governmental agencies to help the natural resource and wildlife inhabitants of their area. They are currently working now on a project on a flood control project at Oak Fork Township in by Moorhead, Minnesota, that requires the acquisition of 28 homes and a permanent levee around 400 homes right along the Red River. Now, that levee those homes that are being acquired are needed to build this levee to protect these other 400 homes. This project's going to bring about a $17 million cost to it when they get done. And I'm sure some of you have probably heard about that. They've been down talking to you before about that. Another one of the watershed districts in central Minnesota is the Clearwater Watershed District, located in parts of Wright, Stearns, and Meeker counties. They encompass about 159 square miles. Now, they were formed to address the phosphorus and other water quality issues caused by the discharging of sewage and industrial effluents, septic tanks, and an ever-growing communities, agricultural waste, stormwater runoff, and soil erosion. Now they, just like all the other watershed districts in the state, have methodically formed working relationships and partnerships with other governmental units and agencies, as well as with the private property owners and environmental groups, to establish and enhance their water quality projects or their water storage projects. These, as well as their other projects, have an ever-growing effect and encourage the economic growth and mainstay of central Minnesota. The last district I think I'm just going to touch on is the one is in Chairman Eakin's district, and that's the Wild Rice Watershed District. Now, the Wild Rice Watershed District encompasses 2,080 square miles in northwestern Minnesota. Now, their goals are to provide flood damage reduction and natural resource enhancements while ensuring agriculture and economic growth for their region. Now, the district, the Wild Rice Watershed District, has taken, a little different approach since 1997. We call it the holistic approach to water management. They have done a comprehensive plan, or what we call the systems approach plan, which not only identifies the problems in the watershed district, but also identifies the solutions. Now, there is always going to be those that don't agree, and that's just the way it goes, but we've done what we call all the environmental and economic and scientific things that we need to do to prove that these solutions are the ones that we need for our problems out there. The district is charged with maintaining 380 miles of drainage system in six counties in which they have jurisdiction. We have also built over 20,000 acre feet of storage projects already in the watershed district and are currently engaging in a small water retention pilot program with the Soil and Water Conservation District. We've also to date built 54 farm storage or farmstead ring banks and have built levees around the towns of Halsted, Hendrum, Shelley, and Purley. Now, we also completed in 2006 the Heiberg Dam restoration project on the Wild Rice River. Now, this included working with FEMA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the White Earth and Red Lake Band or tribes, DNR, and the city of Twin Valley to restore an ice control structure, allow stream stability, install boat access, and allow fish passage on this Wild Rice River. Now, this was a major undertaking, and yes, the dam went out in 2002, and it did take 4 years to get done, but it was a tremendous accomplishment for the river as well as the natural resource enhancements there in that area. We are now currently working on U.S. Army Corps of Engineers studies on the Wild Rice River to look at a channel restoration and levee setback project. again, it's something that is a few years all on the road, but it is going to be a mainstay, we believe, in our flood damage reduction and natural resource enhancement project. There is also an ongoing project on the Felton Ditch, and we have also initiated a project called Project 42 on the south transfer of the Wild Rice River, which has a theory of impoundments to reduce the flow, reduce sediment to increase the water quality, and provide 30-40% flood damage reduction for our district. And this is all in coordination with U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the Department of Natural Resources to promote wildlife and natural resource enhancements. I guess that you can see that watersheds are, you know, in the outstate are addressing just about all quality, all types and aspects of land and water quality. These are just some of the ongoing activities. Like I say, there's numerous ones. If you've got a couple, 3 hours of time, I'd be glad to sit down with you and explain a lot more of them to you. But these are just some of those that are going on in outstate Minnesota. And now I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Barbara Hockey from Mounds View in the Rice Creek watershed.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Hockey, if you could state your name, please.
Ms. Barbara Hockey, and I belong to the Rice Creek Watershed District. I'm also vice president for MOD, which is the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and everybody else for having us here. I really appreciate it. As Ray alluded to, I used to be a member here at the State House, and long story about it, but I decided I didn't want to keep running. I see that when I went back to my watershed districts, this is my most fun thing I've ever done, and I had been on for 5 years, went to the legislature and came back in, and I've been back now for another 3-4 years. I find out I get projects done from A to Z a lot faster than it gets would get things done, but it takes you forever, and I'm an impatient person, so I enjoy being back in water. I am going to be speaking about the urban watershed districts. And Warren, after I heard everything you guys do, I tell you watershed districts are very, very important. I always knew that, but my goodness, what you can accomplish. What we've accomplished in our area, or let's say, first of all, let me just go that urban has a lot of different challenges than some of the rural does. But in my particular watershed district, we have 201 square miles, but the bottom half is all to do with urban area. It's sort of like the outer growth of St. Paul, and then you've got the northern area, and that's more rural. So we've had to try to work with 103B, D, E, but more than that, it's also the Wetland Conservation Act, because when you've got the two together, you've got one, you know, people that are proponents that are to get that ditch and get that water gone as fast as you can, and you've got the other ones that are talking about, let's see what we can do to conserve it, because that's one of the most important things we have is water quality. And then we have all the TMDLs we have to do. I believe watershed districts is the way in the vehicle that's going to be used to perform all the TMDLs that are going to have to be done. But there are 14 watershed districts in the 7-county metro area of the Twin Cities. And each one has all their various different challenges. And you, of course, read about us, I think, sometimes in the paper because we are in the forefront of things that are done when there's development. But we do try to, in our district, to set up like a one-stop shopping, if we're able to help to coordinate things when there's developments that occur. And Representative McGinnis was talking about best management practices, et cetera, when she was talking to Bowser. And that is exactly what we try to do within our area. In fact, ours is to have started something called a comprehensive wetland management plan, and we also do resource management plans. And what this is trying to give everybody the right to have ditches and have their water moved from a particular area, but also to bring in the WACA Act. And again, Gene was mentioning about what about the federal people. And you've got the Corps of Engineers that come into the picture, too. And with the Corps, they have definite black and white rules, and so we've had to work with the Corps on trying to bring in the new ideas of WACA and what can be done to try to preserve some wetlands. So we've got an excellent administration. Steve Hobbs, my administrator, is back here in the corner somewhere, that if you give me real tough questions, I'm going to call him to the forefront. But we have been able to find out a way of, which is my main thing that I wanted to do in the legislature, was to see, wasn't there some way that we can have the land as a substrate and try to have development done according to what the land will, you know, allow. Now, we've got Anoka County, which is a lot of wetlands in our area, and that's where our CWMP came about, and that is to try to route the wetlands and yet still have the high areas that are needed for development. And that was something that is one of the first things in the nation. Another thing that we've done is that we took an area in the middle of Ramsey County that had to be, that had been straight tight ditch, and we redid mandarins, remandered that area, and it's one of the largest streamback stabilization things that have been done in the state. And then another one is that when the other gentleman there that had been, I think if he's still back there, the other representatives talking about something about his, I think, American Legion and streambank stabilization, that is something else that can be done through watershed districts. But we've been really working hard on all of the things that we feel that we're responsible for, and of course within the urban area there are street reconstructions. There's all sorts of things that you're trying to bring back in. You can go into cities and find out that they're so paved over. And so we're trying to bring in new best management practices in that. There's things called rain gardens. So when they reconstruct streets, that they're able to let the water go back into the people's front yard and have the water percolate back into the ground level, groundwater. But I guess I will be quiet here and let you ask questions, but I just can't tell you how enthusiastic I am about watershed districts and how good they are and what they're really worth. And so, anyway, I'm the biggest proponent. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Bowen.
Mr. Chairman, just to wrap up here quickly, to give you some idea of the issues that we're going to be working on this session, clearly the number one issue, I think, this session is the Clean Water Legacy. You know, we were involved in the G16 process for that 3.5 years. That's a critical, we believe it's critical to the future of the state of Minnesota, and it's something that we really, really need to be putting, I think, a larger investment in what we have in the past. So that's extremely critical. And we're doing that in partnership with all the other members of G16. The Wetland Conservation Act updates, that's something that actually Luann Tolliver, who's a manager at the Nine Mile Creek Watershed District and is also a member of Bowser, was chair of that committee, that Bowser committee that actually did that, and you're going to be hearing more about that from Bowser this session. The Drainage Work Group recommendations, we've been working with Representative Hansen the last couple of years on buffer strips, and it actually has evolved from only buffer strips into a whole more thorough discussion of drainage issues. And we're just now coming with recommendations that I think are going to get us past the buffer strip issue, thank goodness, and then actually maybe on to some other important drainage-related issues. So that's been just a tremendous group. I mean, I've really enjoyed it, and Warren was a member of that as well. We really enjoyed our opportunity to be involved with that kind of an ad hoc group. But I think there's real commitment from those members to help work out some of these issues. You know, we have some other housekeeping issues that we'll be talking with you about, but those are the basic, I think, the major issues that we're going to be working on in this session, just to give you some idea of the things that we're involved in on a continual basis.
Well, thank you. I was going to ask, I know the Wild Rice Watershed is involved also in the River Valley Watershed, and I was wondering how many, organizations you have like that where they're cooperating between the different watershed districts and working together, because a lot of the smaller watersheds obviously are part of a much bigger watershed, for instance, in the Red River Valley.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's actually two that I'm aware of. One is the Red River Valley, obviously, is the one that's organized by statute, has been organized since, I think, the mid-70s. They actually have levy authority, and they work on a basin-wide, work together as a basin-wide group. And I think there's, seven or eight watershed districts that are involved in that. And actually have a very good working relationship. The other group that I'm aware of is a joint powers group of counties down in along the southern Minnesota River. That started under Governor Carlson's initiative for the to try to clean up the Minnesota River. And I think that's, as far as I know, I think that's still an ongoing concern. And I know the watershed districts are involved in that, the ones that are down in that area. So, you know, maybe we can talk about that.
Okay. Mr. Sikora.
Also, there's Chairman Eakin and members of the committee. There's also the Red River Basin Commission. Mr. Bowen was referring to the Red River Basin Water Management Board, which is made up of the eight members of the watersheds in the Red River Valley. But the Red River Basin Commission is a organization of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Manitoba, and maybe Saskatchewan in the near future, that is working together to alleviate some of the flood damages and the water quality problems that is caused by all the other watershed districts into the Red River, which flows into Lake Winnipeg. Lake Winnipeg is filled up with about 14 feet of silt in the last X amount of years, and so they're having tremendous water quality problems like Barb knows about down Lake Pepin. So we've been organized now for quite a few years. It used to be the International Joint Commission, and there's different things going on, but the Red River Basin Commission now has been working to try to work together and form federal support and into Canada support for water quality and flood damage reduction in the Red River.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe that's an entity that the state of Minnesota and Representative McGinnis will know this, I'm sure, well, that there is funding provided by the state to help fund that effort along with the other entities involved.
Okay. Representative Beinhardt.
Mr. Chair, presenters, my question is a follow-up about collaborative work, and it piggybacks on just what you mentioned. I represent the Mankato area, and the organization you mentioned of southern Minnesota counties along the Minnesota River is housed at Minnesota State University Mankato, the Minnesota River Board Joint Powers. I'm trying to figure out, some members of that organization have approached us in terms of requesting funding, representatives from this region, and I'm trying to figure out the lines of authority here. As a joint powers board, how are they funded? What's their authority in relation to watershed districts, in relation to the Board of Water and Soil? I just am trying to understand the interconnections there.
Mr. Bowen?
Mr. Chairman,
The
joint powers derives its authority from the individual members, and they're only as strong as the collective of the individual membership. So basically, it's my recollection in the past that, and Bowser could maybe answer that better for you, my recollection in the past is that they were assessed dues every year, and then the county paid dues, and that's what helped at least gave the basis for funding. And I'm sure they went out and got grants and things like that. And of course, the counties have to use their levy authorities to drive those funds for the dues to contribute to that effort. So they really, so it's basically their individual counties' authorities, that's what they're operating on. And I don't know if the watershed districts are direct signers as co-signers onto the joint powers or not down there. But I do know they participate very heavily. Because I know one of the TNDLs down in that area, down on the Yellow Medicine River, which goes into the Minnesota, and I know the Watershed District down there is one of the lead agencies in that TNDL that was completed and actually got some funding out of the last batch of money that the legislature put.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bowen, maybe hearing about some of these projects close by and farther in greater Minnesota that we could visit those during the summer, or maybe some of the Soil and Water Conservation District projects that are close by and see how some of these get into the ground. So I think that's would you be open to that? And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we would be delighted. In fact, I've criticized some of our watershed districts for not going out and telling their story well enough about all the great things they're doing, because it is. It's really phenomenal when you start looking at the different things that some of these watershed districts are doing and the partnerships that they develop, very creative, taking, in some cases, very little money and making it stretch along long ways. Yes. So we would be delighted to organize that if the community so desires.
Thank you. Maybe go to the Wild Rice Watershed. That's not one of the close ones, though.
I think Mr. Chairman called that the Chairman's prerogative.
Yeah. So, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bowen, I represent cities in the metro area, and we have residents of watershed districts who pay taxes for watershed districts, and yet their cities are in a joint powers agreement with watershed management organizations. So, in effect, those people are doubly taxed. And I guess my question, and I've been drawing a little flow chart here because I had the same question you did, Representative Brainard, and I'm wondering why, can you tell me why water management organizations don't form a watershed district? And also then, as a follow-up to that, water management organizations are much less costly, in my opinion, than a watershed district, and it's sort of a form of grassroots water management. Isn't that a preferable system if they could exist, and how are they funded?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Joint Powers Water Management Organizations, again, are only as strong as their weakest link. And what's been the, some experience has been some are very good, but there's been, I think, in the past some issues about whether or not there's implementation actually going on. They sometimes hold a lot of meetings, and maybe that isn't very expensive just to have meetings. But in order in terms of getting stuff down on the ground, again, and it's not a generalization because there are some very good ones out there as well. But I think if you look over the course of the last 5 or 6 years, and maybe a little longer, Bowser actually has the authority to take what they call the non-implementing WMOs. Basically, WMOs, joint powers WMOs that aren't doing anything, and holding their feet to the fire and say, either you do something or we're going to create a watershed district. So that's what the law allows. In fact, I think there have been 7 of them that have been abolished and turned into watershed districts. So I think that tells a little bit of the story in terms of effectiveness and being able to get the job done. And I think what we saw in the past, too, another issue was they were, for many years, the WMOs were basically run by the member cities. And there was very little citizens' input. You know, a lot of times you're meeting over lunch at a local club or something like that, and the citizens didn't really have a chance for input. And I know Representative Osmond, a number of years ago, passed legislation that mandated that over 50% of those members had to be citizen members, which we thought was a very, very good provision. And how far that's come or whether or not they're adhering to it, I really couldn't say. But I think the WMOs, when they work, and if the cities work together and they all pull together, and then they're willing, when the rubber meets the road, that means when they got to start spending some real money on projects to get the job done, you know, are they willing to use their tax money in that way? And what we found, in many cases, that's not the case. That always gets put on the back shelf, the back burner. And that's where watershed districts, with our additional levy authority, and with the kind of the whole watershed approach, look at it a little differently and act a little differently. So that would be my response. But I don't know if anybody else.
I just had a follow-up.
That's Sam Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a follow-up, the local water management organizations who get their money from the cities, if they have a joint powers agreement, and can do a certain amount of projects, by having people, regular citizens, dispersing that money, they're not really accountable to anyone, whereas the elected officials would be accountable. But I'm just wondering where, at what point do they become, under Bowser's coordination, to be forced to become a watershed district, which is a much more expensive operation than a WMO?
Mr. Chairman, it's when they don't do anything. I mean, there's a lot, we've seen a lot of paper tigers in terms of water management in the Twin Cities area. And those are the ones that Bowser has really moved on and said, you got to start doing something. And that's helpful, you know, and they are giving the opportunity, you know, to move and to act. And Bowser doesn't come in there with your ladder and just say, okay, you're not doing anything, so we're going to make your watershed. You're talking 2 or 3 years long before that process really takes its full course. So they're giving every opportunity to actually go, in fact, do their job, and if they're not doing their job, then eventually Bowser does say, we got to get someone in there that's going to do the job. And, you know, you say it's more expensive. I don't know if I would agree with that. The fact of the matter is you're talking about, I guess if we have a sin, maybe it's being more effective. If that means spending more money to enhance water quality, to protect the values of the properties in the watershed district, then I guess that I would say you could accuse us of.
Representative Osmond.
Darren, I'll just to speak to that issue a little bit. I know that WMO that was in my area that it may have been a very cheap organization, but it was very self-serving with regard to local communities. And what they did is they had all their engineers, city engineers and city planners, they were serving on the WMO. And so when they essentially had a plan, a development plan that was approved by the community, by the city, then it became a rubber stamp for the WMO. And the townships ended up getting dumped on, because it was local farmers or other citizens from the townships that were sitting on in their positions. And when you're faced against the professionals that came out of the cities, it just wasn't a fair fight. And so, yes, it was less expensive because the cities were willing to provide all the information. But to really make it an organization that's supposed to be looking at out after everyone's welfare with regard to the water management in that watershed, it really needs to be, care needs to be taken that there is a separation between whatever's fed to you from one community that has a vested interest versus the interests of everyone else that's kind of downstream.
Mr. Bowen?
Oh, and Mr. Chairman, one important element I left out of this discussion, Representative Osmond, is what Dakota County did in that Vermilion area where they were basically having non-implementing WMO. The county has the ability and authority to take over the water management authority, and they did, and actually created a very good WMO between Dakota County and, I think, Scott County. And, in fact, the executive director of that authority, Vermilion Watershed Authority, again, a joint WMO, has actually just been appointed as the director of Bowser. So that works, the counties have to be very proactive, and they have to be supportive. And as long as the counties are on board and they're willing to spend the money that needs to be spent, then it, you know, it works very well. So we're not saying there's one model that works everywhere. But I think, you know, we obviously think our model works pretty good. But in that case, Dakota County works extremely well. That maybe wouldn't work in another county. In fact, we've seen some other counties. Freeborn County was a good example of that. Bowser, I think, gave Freeborn County up to 2 years once the original petition came in, start cleaning up Freeborn, the lake down there, Lake Elderly Lake. And in 2 years, they really didn't do anything. So eventually, Bowser said, okay, county, if you're not going to do it, over the county's objection, establish the watershed district.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a broad question, and it may be a naive one that my senior colleagues may smack me upside the head for asking here. I was in the suburban Ramsey County in Shoreview, and I served on an environmental committee there, and we would have the exact problem that Representative Osmond was talking about, where cities are part of all these structures and couldn't quite figure out where the city and the water organizations were different. We've heard a lot about this in the last few presentations about structure and process and a variety of other things, and I'm just curious if there's any way, in a concise way, to mention if all this structure, process, and rules work. Maybe this is buried in reports somewhere, but you know, having a snapshot of water bodies around the state, with, I don't know if it's TMDL levels or you have specific indicators you want to look at, and where we can measure things over time, but we're micromanaging school money out the wazoo on all sorts of measurement statistics, and whether those are all valid or not is a legitimate question, but I'm having a hard time to tell that 5 years down the road we've made a dent in the problem in cleaning up water quality, and I guess I'd like to know how we're going to figure that out. Now, that's a big, broad, philosophical question, but I guess I'm looking for someone to state in a one- or two-pager where we're at, where we're going, and how we're going to know we've accomplish something if we do something new.
Mr. Bowen?
Mr. Meekin, Representative, I guess the way to... No, it's very tough to measure the outcomes of the water quality issues, because you have to first find out what your problems are. The TMDLs that have come down will start giving us guidelines, but they're just been in the last few years. Watershed districts, from their...
beginning have changed. What we did 30 years ago, and I believe all watershed districts, and soil and waters for that matter, was to improve the land by drainage. And we, there was programs that paid farmers to go out and drain land. Blow ditches with dynamite if you couldn't get in there with a cat and scraper or something else, or drag line. I mean, there was all kinds of actions going on out there to improve the land for agricultural purposes. As far as rural development, same thing. It was, concrete doesn't absorb much water. Well, things have changed nowadays, so there's different types of concrete and asphalt that has been designed to absorb water. So things have been getting better, but to actually get out and start measuring it out on the land, like our projects nowadays that are either been in place, have an operation and maintenance plan and tied to them, and they're revisited from time to time to make sure that they are working and they are doing what they were supposed to, not what they were probably designed for 30 years ago, but for the modern day rules and regulations that we live with. The ditch systems, like I mentioned before, we have 380 miles of them that we have to maintain for various reasons during the course of the year. And grass to ditch buffers have been a very big mainstay of those. It's tough to enforce. Not every landowner wants to give up that 16 and a half feet or whatever, but the benefits have been proven time and time again that the grass buffers along these ditch systems do improve water quality and do improve the phosphorus levels that have come into these streams and rivers. So there's, as far as the managing that's going on, as far as like in our district, we've been working now with the PPA for a and with the federal government not stormwater, it's called a flow monitoring something or another, big long title anyway, but it means that we're going to be monitoring water coming into our project and coming out. And prior to the project, construction and afterwards. And we will be able to start telling. And in fact, there's no doubt in most people's minds that if we slow down the flows, we slow down the sediment, you are going to have better water quality. It's just a proven fact. So that's what we're doing out there as far as rural Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, just to follow
up. Ms. Hockey.
Thank you. Representative, you said Shoreview. Mr. Gardner. Representative Gardner. I've got Steve Hobbs behind me here, and what I'd like to do is have you connect with him sometime to find out exactly what Rice Creek Watershed's doing in your area, because we're taking care of your water. We're carrying your water. We have monitoring done. We've got quite a few different statistics already on our monitoring, what we do with our water quality. And as Warren had said, it's all the deal with keeping the water on the property where it falls and then also holding it and making sure that we can see if we get better water quality when it comes back out. So we do have things that we probably could give you some record of that, and it'd be more scientific data, which is what I think you're probably looking for.
Yes,
so
just as a follow-up comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
I strongly recommend that if you have numbers, just publicize the heck out of it, because there's people who would just, at least in our area, who would thrive and look over that with great meticulous detail and could be your best friends in advocating in their communities for everything from sweeping up grass clippings to, you name it. So, I like the watershed district idea. I come from the Washington, D.C. area where everyone's concerned about the Chesapeake Bay, and so they have these what you call mega districts for the whole Potomac River, for the whole Susquehanna, and I sometimes think we've got this jigsaw puzzle of districts all over the state, and sometimes I don't get the impression that there's any sort of cohesion or big picture. There might be, but I'm not getting it. So anyway, talking about the numbers in plain English would help all of us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, will get something to you.
And Mr. Sikora, did you have any comments? Or?
Just a little follow-up. I think if I remember right, I think in Representative Saylor's district, the Pelican Watershed District is doing an awful lot of water quality, and I think they've got a lot of numbers up there. You talked to Tara Gutter, and she's got numbers on everything from the mercury to whatever they're doing in their watershed district. They are basically a water or a lake watershed district, but they've been also putting in sediment basins on the farmland that they do have, because they are in very rural topography. and they've been installing tremendous amount of sediment basins up there for the water quality issues and erosion, of course.
Mr. Bone.
Mr. Chairman, one of the elements of the Clean Water Legacy is this whole issue of monitoring after the fact as well, to ensure that the water quality, you know, is what we expect it to be, and in fact is maintained, at least maintained, and hopefully getting better. So that's a really big issue and a big element in after the restoration, you know, making sure that in fact things are staying the way they should stay, and hopefully even getting better.
Okay. Representative Osmond.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. President Gardner, I'm afraid your fears are going to be well-founded as you get more involved in this. You're going to find out there really is no base of solid knowledge as to what's happening across the state of Minnesota, the process that we have mechanisms in place where people have underneath the theory that if they want to play, they don't want to pay. And some have said that's enough, so they have established things like watershed districts and so forth to try and bring some logic and reason and fairness into how to manage this whole process. But when you get all across the state, the best thing we have going for us right now is to support the enforcement of the Clean Water Act, and the MPCA needs to continue to monitor our waters and find out where they're impaired, and if we get those TMDLs established watershed by watershed, so we can actually start addressing the problems and do it in a coordinated fashion. There is no organization or body that has a full compilation of all the data that has even been collected to this point. And there's been a lot of data collected, but not everywhere. But even that's been collected is not coordinated and not accessible. It's extremely frustrating, and we sure look forward to your help.
Great, that was the answer. But thank you for your knowledge there.
Mr. Bone.
Just one final comment, Representative Scalzi, we'd be happy to work with you in cleaning up the tax language, because I agree, people shouldn't have to pay for both a WMO and a watershed district. They ought to be paying for what they're getting, and I'd be happy to work with you on that.
Thank you. Ms.
One more thing, I know it's probably time here, but to follow up with what Representative Osmond has just said, the TMDLs, this is the other thing that I believe watershed districts would do so well at, is that we are gathering our data within our area, and we also have the taxing authority, and I think that you're going to depend upon quite heavily watershed districts also to help out on the Clean Water Act and TMDLs. So that's another important element. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Well, I just wanted to say I have a lot of respect for those of you who serve on watershed boards. Ms. Hockey, you left the house to join the watershed board. I don't know if I would do that myself. But, that's kind of like jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire, in my view. But just one question. Is that the reason that watershed boards aren't elected? Is because of the shield them some from the heat?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the members, yeah, that's precisely it. I mean, I think when watershed districts were developed, they were purposely not made elected because they thought that they should be a step removed from the politics. And I think it's worked well over the last 40-50 years, and frankly it does, because people can do the right thing, and people tend to leave, I think, their agendas at the door for the most part, and work for the benefit of the whole district, and I think that works extremely well.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
And we are going to adjourn next meeting. We're going to be hearing from the legislative auditors, so maybe address some of the issues that Representative Osmond and Gardner were speaking of. And the report's going to be on Bowser and the watersheds. So until then, the meeting is adjourned.